Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now happening on our website, your anecdotal census, a people's history of the New York City area from 2000 to 2010. As the official census takers make their rounds from now through summer to collect those 10 question forms, we are collecting your stories of change in our communities over the last decade. We have a separate page for each county in our listening area. So go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, find the page for your county, and post a story of change that has mattered to your local community over the last 10 years. And we will talk about these on the air, county by county, every Tuesday through the summer. Right now, did you see that article in the Times about how the British, speaking of the British, are moving away from believing that human activity is changing the climate? It cited a survey that showed the percentage of people who believe that climate change is happening and is now established as largely man-made has dropped from 41% in November 2009 to just 26%. Now, it has dropped in this country too, but not nearly that much. My next guest is concerned about these kinds of gaps between science and the public mind, but he's not a scientist himself. He's a philosopher. Massimo Piliucci is a professor of philosophy at the City University of New York, and his new book is Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. Welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be here, Brian.
You know, our first comment on our webpage on this segment this morning comes from Ed from Larchmont, who says that between science and bunk, there is science that turns out to be wrong, and that's not an infrequent occurrence. So is that really a separate category, or is Ed mistaken in what science really is?
No, it's not a separate category. It's a really complex continuum. It's there's pseudoscience. There's clearly pseudoscience on one end, like, you know, astrology is the obvious example. There is really good and solid science on the other hand. Fundamental physics is the other obvious example. And then there's a lot of stuff in between. And a lot of the things in between may, in fact, start out as science or proto-science and then end up into the pseudoscience category because they turn out to be completely wrong and yet people still believe them. Or vice versa, they may develop into serious science.
But as a philosopher of science, you also set out to discover for yourself or clarify for yourself what science really is. Is that question really in doubt?
It is it's somewhat in doubt in the sense that philosophers early on had very simple answers to that question. And it turned out that when you look at the history and even the sociology of science, the situation is much more complicated. I was actually, before I became a philosopher about a year ago. Before that, I was a scientist for 25 years.
Uh-huh.
And so I have sort of firsthand experience. I was a biologist. And there are several areas of biology or physics, for instance, where it's still kind of difficult to tell what the difference is. But fundamentally, I think of science as a human activity that deals with discovering things about the natural world, and that is based on producing hypotheses and theories that are empirically testable. If you're doing that, if you're producing empirically testable hypotheses about the world, then you're doing science.
One of the examples you cite where believing bunk has lethal consequences is AIDS denial in Africa.
Right.
What was behind that? A lack of options, the vestiges of colonialism, religion, what?
Yeah, as was the case for Agatha Christie's murder on the Orient Express, everybody's a culprit, right? It turns out that it's all of the above. There is an understandable resentment that is a leftover of colonialism in certain countries, and a distrust of Western medicine in general. There is a pride in local local traditions. There is also a lot of conspiracy theorizing about big pharma and how they're making money, the CIA going around and, you know, killing people on purpose and so on and so forth. Now, there is all sorts of good reasons to be skeptical of things like, for instance, big pharma, because they have their share of trouble. They cause their share of trouble. But the denial of the connection between HIV and AIDS is a classic example of how pseudoscience, especially if endorsed by a government, actually, it results literally in hundreds of thousands or millions of people dying or getting sick.
Listeners, what's the difference between science and bunk, and how do you tell? My guest has written the book, Nonsense on Stills, How to Tell Science from Bunk. How do you, especially in the face of uncertainty or on the one hand this, on the other hand that, reporting in the media? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Massimo Piliucci, 212-433-9692, or post WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. You can ask about particular examples or suggest particular examples or deal with this a little bit more abstractly. You write about global warming, as we mentioned, but you say that you're not interested in the global warming controversy per se, but in what it may tell us about the complex intertwining of science, pseudoscience, ideology, and the media. What does it tell us about that?
It tells us that science has remarkably little, small role to play, actually, in the public understanding of the controversy. Let me step back for a second. So in the United States, we think that there is a controversy about climate change, that there is a controversy about evolution, that there is a controversy about the connection between vaccines and autism and several others. It turns out that the numbers, in the general public vary between, 25 to 40% or even 50% skeptics about these issues. If you, however, look within the relevant scientific communities, that is medical researchers, climate scientists or evolutionary biologists, there is essentially no controversy. Or there are technical discussions, of course, there's technical disagreements, but there's essentially no controversy. To me, that says a lot about how Americans tend to be informed or misinformed about science. Yes, I can blame you. We can blame the media to some extent because there is this tendency of, liking the controversy. It's much more interesting to talk about a controversy than to say, well, no, actually, there isn't any controversy if we understand what's going on. But that is it's only part of the problem. It seems to me that part of the blame goes to scientists themselves. Many scientists do not talk to the general public. There's no incentive in talking. In fact, there are disincentives in talking to the general public because the more time you spend writing and talking to the public, the less time you have to write the next scholarly paper or a grant proposal. And those are the things that actually make or break your academic career. Those are the things that get you tenure and so on and so forth. So there are classic examples, for instance, one that I get into some detail in the book, of very good scientists who, like Carl Sagan, the astronomer, who were denied admission into the National Academy of Science, even though their scientific record was just as good as anybody else that was admitted during that time. But the perception was that surely Sagan wasn't a serious enough scientist because he spent a lot of time talking to the general public and writing for the general public. But part of the problem is also the public itself. It seems to me that we ought to take seriously the idea that living in an open democratic society means that we have an ethical duty to inform ourselves about what's going on in the world. And I'm not talking about abstruse controversies in, say, quantum mechanics. I mean, frankly, who cares? Yes, the technical people who work in that area care. And if I'm curious intellectually in general, I might. But if you're talking about vaccines, AIDS, climate change, those are things that actually involve us, our children, our future. So those are the kinds of issues where really we ought as a public to inform ourselves.
Richard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello. Richard, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I just see climate change as an example of taking science and converting it into pseudoscience. By means of separating the two arguments, is nature responsible or human society, when in fact it's a cumulative and a constantly changing ratio of the two, producing the final effect. Why does one right make the other one wrong?
That's a good question. I mean, a lot of the so-called controversy in the public sphere about climate change is based on the idea that, well, but we actually have evidence that there are natural changes in climate, which is absolutely true. They have occurred in the past, and we have very good reasons to think that they are contributing right now. But, of course, to say that if it is one thing, it cannot be the other is to commit a classic logical fallacy. The two are not mutually exclusive. In fact, what is worrisome is precisely the fact that human contribution to climate change is, in fact, compounding a natural trend. If the natural trend at this particular moment were going down instead, which has happened in the past, then we probably would have much less of a problem. But it is precisely the fact that we happen to be in a period where both the natural trend is going up and human contributions are making it worse. That's what's causing the problem, and that's what's making it more complex than it would be otherwise.
But the complexity also gets lost in the media in another way, I think. For example, you chalk up the problems with gaining acceptance for global warming to politics. But if the science isn't settled, and part of the science isn't settled, I think that there's still disagreement over what the computer models predict for the future, because there are ranges. Isn't it rational for there to be disputes over how the data should be interpreted, especially when there are such high costs involved?
To some extent, that's true. But we need to understand what it means for the problem not being settled. So there's essentially no disagreement, again, within the relevant scientific community that human-made climate change is happening. The models do make different predictions within a certain range. That's the whole point of having a model. Models are kind of, you know, thought experiments. You put in certain information, and they give you what happens if certain things are true or not true. But the fundamental thing to understand is that no matter what model you pick, the predictions do range from worrisome to really catastrophic. They don't range from, well, nothing is happening, to we should do something about it.
Yeah.
That's one thing. The other thing is, from a political perspective, what I honestly do not understand is the idea that one needs to deny the reality of the phenomenon because one may disagree on what to do about it. So, for instance, right recently on my blog, I posted a question that was, you know, why is it that so many libertarians, not all of them, but so many libertarians joined the group of global warming, deniers? And the question is interesting because there seems to be a link between a particular political position, I don't want the government to do to take on big projects or to solve my problems or whatever, and the actual rejection of the science. It seems to me that the two are completely logically independent. One could say, yes, the best science that we know of so far does tell me that there is a problem. Now let's talk about how do we solve it, and there may or may not be a role for government, and we can talk about what that role may be.
And on the other side, do you think there's a cultural bias toward small is beautiful, industrialism is bad, etc.?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, both the right and the left actually can use science issues as from an ideological perspective. And yes, it's certainly the case that on the progressive side, there is this continuous drumbeat about, well, the big industry is bad across the board. In the book, I recount an interesting little experiment that was done by Penn and Teller, who are magicians who also specialize in debunking the sort of notion of pseudoscience. And they once sent an associate of them to an environmentalist rally, and they talked to these really nice people, young people who are really concerned about the environment. And these people were asked to sign a petition to ban a very widespread chemical that it's in our food supply, it's everywhere in our environment, the government should really be doing something about it. The chemical in question is dihydrogen monoxide, otherwise known as water. And you wouldn't believe the number of people. It was very discouraging.
Dihydrogen, H2, mm-hmm. monoxide.
Exactly.
Oh.
Exactly. And a lot of people signed that petition, which clearly was a fairly abysmal example of lack of critical thinking on the left.
Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted, in addition to the guest book, wanted to make a recommendation about what I consider to be a great classic in this, particularly in the context of biology, which was mentioned as somewhat lacking compared to some of the other sciences. It's called Science as a Way of Knowing, The Foundations of Modern Biology by John Moore. It's a great book on the intersection between philosophy of science, history of science, and actual science. I also want to make a small plug, and I have nothing to do with them, for scienceblogs.com as a great place for folks to go and find information on fighting the woo and pro-rationality.
Give me one morsel from either one, either from the John Noor book or from that website.
Oh, gosh. Well, the website, scienceblogs.com, it's a compendium of many, many bloggers. It's most known for Faringula, excuse me.
One morsel of content.
Oh, well, unfortunately, in the United States, the power of the Christian right to influence the discussion on biology and probably global warming, too. And also, follow the money, follow the power. It's all about money and power.
Steve.
I'm afraid, when it comes to the global warming issue.
Steve, thank you very much. Before you go, where should an individual who's not trained in the sciences start if somebody's confused. And there's, you know, much reason for people to feel that they can't really make up their minds. They're not technically trained. The media often presents debates as if everything is equivalent. You know, and many things are complex and should be debated. Some things are falsely debated. But, you know, how are people supposed to sort those things out?
It's an excellent question, especially now in the age of the Internet. It's very confusing because you can just type in a couple of keywords on Google and the first things that come out could be a random sample that has nothing to do with the quality of the websites. I would say the very first stop probably should be the Scientific American website, because it is very thoughtful. There's a lot of information there. They have a section about Ask the Expert where you can actually submit your questions. It's a very good starting point. If people are interested in science education in particular and biology more broadly, the National Center for Science Education website is an excellent resource. Those would be my two favorite starting points. Unfortunately, I have to say, an obvious starting point, which is not a good one, is websites like the National Academy of Sciences and organizations like that, because they do have a lot about science for the general public, but it tends to be really dry and very difficult to read. You fall asleep in a couple of minutes. It's good for your insomnia if you actually have it.
Massimo Piliucci, professor of philosophy at the City University of New York. His new book is Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk. Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next with Al and Tipper Gore kissing each other goodbye, we will take your calls on and talk to an expert on elder divorce. And one of the things we'll touch on is all those couples who get divorced as soon as the kids go off to college. What is that like when you're a freshman? Stay with us.